159, DeAnda versus Becerra. Ms. Dixon.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Courtney Dixon for the secretary. Despite not a single allegation that plaintiff's minor children have sought or are likely to seek Title X services, the district court held that the Title X program is violating plaintiff's rights as a parent, and on that basis vacated an HHS regulation nationwide under the APA, even though plaintiff did not bring an APA claim. That conclusion was wrong at every step, and this court should reverse. This case starts and ends with standing, Your Honors, plaintiff.
Yeah, I want to understand that a little bit better. That there are certainly situations where your argument makes sense, but this one, to me, it's a little bit difficult because the whole point is you don't know what your kid's going to do on something like this. And if your kid knows you don't want them to go have sex when they're 15, they're certainly not going to tell you, but they want to go and get some medicine so that they don't end up pregnant. And so how the heck is he going to know that? Because that's exactly what they're not going to tell you in that situation, right?
Your Honor, your plaintiff hasn't even alleged the specific ages of his children.
Well, I understand that, but they're under 18. There's three girls. So at some point before they're 18, more than likely, they're going to be old enough and in a position to get pregnant. They're also going to be in a position where people are wanting to have sex with them, okay? And so they certainly might agree with their dad's religion and totally be respectful, and this would never come up. But again, what if they're not? They're not going to tell their dad. They're going to act like, oh yeah, dad, yeah, and then they're going to sneak into this Title X building, right? And that's what he's trying to avoid.
It's plaintiff's burden to establish standing, and here we're at summary judgment. Plaintiff's affidavit in support of summary judgment is in the record at page 627. Plaintiff provides that he is the father of three minor daughters in Texas, that he is raising his children to share his values, that he wishes to be informed and to consent if they were to seek services. Again, he does not provide even the specific ages of his own children that could substantiate a likelihood that, again, it's certainly impending or there's a future risk that is substantial and imminent that his children would seek these services. Plaintiff has not identified.
You know, let me just pick up on what, Judge Haynes took the words right out of my mouth. Let me ask it this way. One of the major purposes of the Title X program, and certainly that's become very clear in the light of the most recent regulation, is to make sure that adolescents receive services, including prescription contraceptives, and that their parents not be notified. That seems to me to be Judge Bork in 1983 speculated or thought that that might be the purpose. But now we know it is because of the new regulation, which, I mean, just to quote it, says, nor can any Title X project staff notify a parent or guardian before or after a minor. Now, look, that might be great policy. It might be terrible policy. We're not here for policy. But that seems to be very important to HHS as a policy matter, that there be no notification of the parent. And in this litigation, HHS is making the argument that the program, as administered, overrides any state law right to notification. So I take it as a given that this policy against notification of parents is important. I take that. I don't say that to criticize it or not. It's important for a variety of reasons that we can discuss. But it seems odd to me, just as to piggyback on what Judge Haynes says, that then the department comes in and says, well, a parent with minor daughters in Texas, in a region where tens of millions of dollars are spent per year to make sure these services get to minors, has no standing, isn't injured in any cognizable way, and so shouldn't even be able to come in the courthouse. That's a very strange thing about this case that I stumble over, frankly.
So 2 points. First, to a clarification point.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
First, It's not true that Title X is trying to encourage that parents not be notified. The statute says encourage family participation.
I just don't understand that, because the regulation says project staff may not notify a parent or guardian before or after a minor has requested and received Title X family planning services. I mean, that if that's a policy that the government likes, great. That's why we have a government, right, to make policies. But I don't understand let's put it this way. Here's what Judge Bork said in 1983. It would be no small matter to decide, as proponents of the rule would put it, that the federal government will assist teenagers in conducting active sexual lives, but that their parents may not be told.
So
is that not the policy of the federal government?
The direction with the regulation, Your Honor, is referring to Title X grantees. No, Title X grantees on their own cannot reach out and notify parents.
Uh-huh.
The Title X grantee is to encourage the patient, the participant in the Title X program, to include their family in their decision making. Of course, that is an encouragement in the statute. And again, I can get to the merits questions, but if the provider encourages family participation, of course, we want parents to be included if that is the patient's desire, and the patient in that circumstance, yes, could notify their parents. But with respect to the standing question, Your Honor, again, it's plaintiff's burden to establish a standing.
Okay, well, on that point, Texas has, let's assume for purposes of this question and this argument, I guess, that the father of the minor daughters has a state law right to be notified if his daughters attempt to receive, before they can receive prescription contraceptive services. He has that right. So imagine there's a fence around his home that says, okay, I'm helping you be a parent here, right? I'm helping you be a parent. I don't want to encourage my daughters to have sex before marriage, so I want to be notified. So the state's helping you. The federal government comes in this case and says, well, we've taken the fence away. We preempt it. No more fence for you. Good luck. Maybe your daughters will listen to you. I hope they do, but maybe they won't. But we're taking the fence away. Now, how can we say he's not injured by that?
Plaintiff has not provided any evidence that is specific to himself, his own situation, to substantiate any likelihood.
What would he need to allege?
Again, the specific ages of his children, Your Honor. I mean,
that's all we're lacking here, just age. My daughter's 15.
Even that bare minimum is not provided here. Plaintiff also has not even identified.
But can't we infer that from his pleadings? I mean, he says he has three minor daughters. He's concerned about their, he's concerned about their sexual abstinence.
We're at summary judgment, Your Honor. The district court didn't make any such finding. The district court held, and plaintiff's argument is, that the mere existence of a state law protecting his interests is enough.
Are you saying if he'd said 15, he would have standing?
Your Honor, I think at a bare minimum, that would at least get him closer. It would provide any such information.
Well, shouldn't we remand and let him make that allegation?
I would also, again, as I was saying, he hasn't even identified a Title X provider from whom his children might seek contraception.
Well, how many millions of dollars of Title X money has been spent in Region 6 in the last year?
And certainly the provision of Title X services is important nationwide. The district court, again, cited public statistics concerning the operation of the Title X program in 5 states. But this court's precedent squarely forecloses that.
Well, in 2022, it's $26,520,156. So the federal government comes in 2022 and spends $26 million to get Title X services, including to minors, and forbids any notification of their parent. I mean, it's again, one may think this is a great policy. We're just talking about whether the parent who has a state law right to be notified, which has been overridden by the federal government that then comes and spends $26 million to effectuate the program, that he doesn't have any cognizable injury?
So
hard to accept.
The mere provision of Title X services in the state, again, doesn't say anything about plaintiff's own children seeking those services without his consent. This court has repeatedly rejected standing theories based on that kind of general statistics.
Yeah, but okay, let's go back to their ages. If we were to conclude that for standing they have to have their ages, that sounds like something you have to send back. But I also want to note that it's my understanding periods can start pretty young. Not 5, but some even, I think, 8 or 9-year-olds get their periods. So it's not 15. 10 is pretty common. So it is not that old that these young girls need to be old enough to get pregnant should they have this interaction with this other guy. that they're trying to, again, get medicine, get advice, deal with the fact that they had the sex and address that, whatever it is. And he's trying to avoid that pathway. Because once she's gone and had sex with someone, she's not a virgin when she gets married. And again, I'm not myself judging that. I'm simply saying he would on his religion, and I respect that.
You know, I don't think we're in a circumstance here where we're parsing through statutory allegations and, you know, trying to nitpick particular facts or asking for anything unreasonable here. Again, we're at summary judgment. Plaintiff has not even provided bare facts that would establish.
Well, I don't know why that's not bare that he is. I can understand if he never had kids and he's saying, someday I might have some daughters. I'm a little worried about this. Okay, maybe you could say that's too far down the road. But he says he has three daughters under 18. And I'm saying you don't have to be that old to get to a point where you could potentially get pregnant. And so, why isn't, you said he has to say, oh, I think that they're all going to go have sex before marriage. And he's hopeful that's not true. But as I said, not every parent knows what every young kid or older kid is thinking and doing. That's part of the difficulty of being a parent. And I'm not the expert on that. One of my colleagues is much more of an expert on that. I don't have any kids. But I'm well aware of what I just said.
And, you know, I think we're in a situation here where we're just missing, again, bare facts to establish any such likelihood, and the district court excused plaintiff of having to show any such likelihood.
Tell me exactly what a parent would have to say to have standing in your view.
Again, Your Honor, I mean, I'm not going to prejudge any complaint that I haven't seen, and yes, there may be difficult questions on the margin of what constitutes a substantial likelihood. But again, here we don't even have the specific ages of plaintiff's own children. The district court believed, again, that the mere...
Let's say you said 12, 15, and 13.
One can imagine saying, you know, I have children that are of a specific age. I mean, plaintiff in his own brief, again, tries to limit his theory to parents of children of childbearing years, but that's not in the affidavit that he provided to the district court, and that wasn't the...
Would that be enough? I'm just asking, is that enough in your view? What bare minimum is enough in your view?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not going to say definitively if I haven't seen a complaint, but again, I think the ages, I think identifying a particular Title X provider in the area, one could say, you know, I have teenagers, they have driver's license, there's a Title X provider down the street.
Why wouldn't a father of a seven-year-old daughter say soon, you know, in I don't know how many months or years, my daughter will be of an age where if she did receive contraceptives without my knowledge, that interferes in a dramatic way with my ability to parent, because the child now has a means of engaging in sexual activity and avoiding certain consequences of it, and that, I think, I would assume everyone would agree, makes it more likely that it would happen. I mean, so you mentioned a couple times the Title X provider. I mean, can't we take judicial notice of whether there are Title X providers in Region 6?
Again, Region 6 includes five states, Your Honor. I think it's relevant to...
Okay, well...
There's a Title X provider in my area. To be very clear about why this matters, I mean, the Title X program, HHS is a, you know, federal program making voluntary services available at Title X clinics. Mm-hmm. No one has to visit a Title X clinic. Plaintiff is free to instruct his children never to do so, absent some indication, some likelihood, something to show that it is likely, certainly impending that his children will access or visit these services. Plaintiff's parental rights remain intact.
I wonder if the focus on whether the children will do X, Y, or Z is the right focus when the claim, he's not suing on behalf of his children. He's suing on behalf of himself. So the focus ought to be on the exercise of his parental right, not on what the child does.
So plaintiff relies on a Texas state law, mm-hmm, that provides parents of minor children the right to consent to certain medical and dental care provided to their child, subject to exceptions. Absent some indication that HHS, a Title X provider, is going to provide medical care to one of his children, there's nothing to which plaintiff could even theoretically consent. And again, we're talking about, you know, plaintiff standing to bring a case in federal court. I'm not questioning plaintiff's interest as a parent. He may have grievances about the Title X program. He may disagree with the program.
I don't mean to keep asking the same question, but I'm just struggling with how is he supposed to know this? if some 15-year-old little girl came in and goes, hey, Dad, I'm going to go have sex, goodbye, and ran out the door, that's pretty unlikely if they know their dad is going to be really furious and upset about that and probably hold them in the house permanently or something like that. So, again, I'm not saying that there aren't any kids that would tell their parents something they think the parents disagree with, but, and I'm a little older than 15, but my memory is that a lot of the people I knew didn't tell their parents things that they were doing that were wrong. I, of course, didn't do anything wrong, but I'm just saying. So I don't understand.
I apologize if I sound like a broken record, Gerard. I mean, I don't think we're, again, asking for anything unreasonable here or asking for, you know, some kind of factual allegation that would be unreasonable. Here, there's just even the barest of facts that would substantiate a likelihood wasn't provided. The district court excused plaintiff.
Well, I'm sorry, I kept you past your hour.
No, please, I'm obviously happy to finish the thought. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court has.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The district court correctly held that Mr. DeAnda has Article III standing to sue Secretary Becerra over his interpretation and implementation of the Title X statute. The district court was also correct in holding that there is nothing in the Title X statute that preempts state laws that require parental consent before prescription contraception can be dispensed to minor children. With the court's permission, I'll begin with the Article III standing questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to flip the switch of all the questions I was asking her. Now I'm going to turn to what if there is a daughter who is afraid that she might be raped and wants to get the right medication and so forth to prevent any problems for him, but certainly doesn't want to tell her dad about it. So she's not trying to have sex for fun, but she's trying to avoid getting pregnant if some, you know, kid at this terrible high school she's at rapes her. How can she not have the right to that?
She may very well have that right, but I don't think that issue is presented at all in Mr. DeAnda's challenge. This is a question of whether Secretary Becerra has the prerogative to declare Texas's parental consent law preempted.
No, I'm saying the right of teenagers to have some medical rights regardless of what their parents think.
Yes.
My memory pre-Dobbs is that Texas had a rule that the parents had to consent to abortion, but also allowed kids, you know, teenagers to go get the government to, I mean, the court to allow it. You could go to family court, for example, in Dallas and get approval if you didn't want to go through your parents. So there was some mechanism, but I don't see that here in your argument. And so you've got this little kid or this little teenager trying to deal with some issues and she doesn't have any rights. How do you address that?
So to my knowledge, Judge Haynes, I don't think there's been litigation over whether the constitutional rights in Griswold and Eisenstadt can be subject to some type of constitutionally required judicial bypass. And I think the reason for that is very few states have this type of parental consent law. To my knowledge, Texas is the only state that has an explicit parental consent requirement for minors to receive contraception. So I'm not aware of any constitutional challenge that has been litigated. But to answer your question, there might be a constitutional right if the Supreme Court or a lower court were to decide this under Griswold or Eisenstadt to obtain prescription contraception or family planning devices without a parent's knowledge or consent in the way abortion was done prior to Dobbs. Now, again, it was a dicey question. The Supreme Court said you could have parental notification or perhaps one parent parental consent, but there would have to be judicial bypass. I just don't know how the courts would come out ultimately on that question. But to us, that's an entirely separate question from whether the Title X statute allows Secretary Becerra to come in and declare our state law preempted by the Title X statute. Maybe there's a constitutional right that could undermine the Texas law, but that's a different lawsuit for a different time. This case is only about the Title X statute and whether the text of that law authorizes Secretary Becerra to do what he did in this regulation and what the government's been doing for the past 40 years in the way they've interpreted the statute.
Okay, so how do you respond to the constant answer that your client didn't even say how old these girls were? And if they're 2 years old, they are not going to get pregnant.
So what we said is they're under the age of 18 in the declaration. We also said in the pleading, as someone pointed out earlier, that they were of childbearing age. I understand that's not in the declaration, so that can't be used to prove standing at the stage.
Well, why not? Why was that not in the...
Because we don't believe it matters. And here's why. Our injury, in fact, does not come from Mr. DeAnda's prediction that his daughters are going to go behind his back to a Title X project to get contraception. That's not the alleged injury. There are many different alleged injuries, but none of them depend on the age of his children. The first and most obvious injury is he has lost a state law entitlement that he had under Section 151.0016 of the Texas Family Code to consent to the medical treatment of his children. Now, he's lost only a small sliver of that right. You know, this preemption argument the government's making only extends to family planning services dispensed by Title X providers. But the size of that injury doesn't matter under Article 3.
But you still need standing. If a law was passed that said you can only drink 10 glasses of wine, I wouldn't give a flip about that. So it doesn't affect someone who's, except the people drinking 11 glasses of wine every night or something. And so the fact is you still need to be affected by it even if you don't like it.
Well, you still need to be someone who would exercise that right if you have it. And a person who has no interest in drinking wine isn't going to want to exercise whatever state law right he might have had under the 21st Amendment to drink however much he wants. In Mr. DeAnda's case, he does want to exercise the state law right, and it doesn't matter when it would occur. Massachusetts against EPA is a good example of this. The alleged injury to Massachusetts' coastline was decades, maybe centuries away, but the increased risk was immediate. That was how the injury was framed in Massachusetts. Now here, it's more than just increased risk.
I wonder if you have to say, do you have to say increased risk at all? It seems the injury to his parental rights is actual and immediate.
It is, yes. So there are many different theories. Four different theories of standing we've described in our brief. And we put the increased risk injury forth for a reason. That's a little more edgy than the other three. The loss of a state law entitlement is the cleanest way to show that there's injury in fact here, because that is immediate. He used to have a state law entitlement to consent to medical treatment of his children regardless. Some of that has been taken away, allegedly, by the federal defendant's preemptive actions. That in itself is injury, in fact, because he had a state law entitlement, he has lost that, a piece of it. Again, not all of it. Most of his rights under Section 151.001A6 have been preserved. But again, the size of the injury doesn't matter. The Supreme Court has said many times an identifiable trifle is all that's needed to establish injury in fact. One helpful analogy might be if one supposes that Congress passed a law tomorrow that says all parental consent laws relating to medical treatment are hereby preempted, period. And they enact that, it's signed into law by the president. Any parent could sue in Texas simply because their pre-existing state law right that they had has been taken away by this federal statute. They don't need to wait to actually have one of their children get medical treatment that they didn't want to consent to. In fact, they would still have standing to challenge this even if all the medical providers in Texas said, we'll continue seeking parental consent for a treatment of minors, just as a matter of courtesy. The mere fact that a state law entitlement has been taken away and stripped by the federal government gives you injury in fact. Doesn't mean that you'll win on the merits, of course.
I mean, when states change abortion laws in the wake of Dobbs and cut back on abortion rights here and they expand over here, I constantly hear people saying we should move from one state to the other so as to protect our putative right to have an abortion, and that's, I can't live here, I have to go live there. As a parent, I'm assuming would be considering the same calculus if one state said you can consent to medical treatment, but the state I'm living in says you can no longer consent to medical treatment for your children. I can imagine people might want to move.
Yeah.
Because of the actual, you say sliver, destruction of that right.
Yes, well, it's the destruction of that sliver of the right. What I'm trying to say is that the broad protection for parental rights still remains outside the context of family planning in Title X. But I think the analogy is a sound one, Judge Duncan, because if one thinks about abortion restrictions that are being imposed in the wake of Dobbs, a woman of childbearing age should have standing to challenge that, even if she's not immediately pregnant, because she has lost that ability that she previously had before Dobbs, because it's now been preempted in a way. Preemption is not quite the right word.
Yeah.
But the state law entitlement that previously existed in a pre-Dobbs world is now gone, and she doesn't have to be pregnant to challenge that. And it's a similar situation here.
The key case, if I may shift just a second, the key case that seems to be discussed by the parties, certainly by the department, is the TransUnion case. And that's held up as a case that defeats your standing per se. And I was wondering what your response to that is.
There's a lot of things about TransUnion I think that need to be discussed. The first is that TransUnion involves a congressionally created cause of action. And we are not in any way quarreling with the holding of Lujan and the holding of TransUnion, that Congress lacks the authority to confer by statute standing on litigants who lack injury in fact. The real question, I think, from TransUnion is, what is an injury in fact? And the opinion talks about no concrete harm, no standing. And there's some language that seems to indicate that a concrete harm has to be tied to some type of injury that traditionally was the basis for legal redress of common law. But at the same time, there are all sorts of injuries that have long been recognized as injury in fact that don't meet that criteria. For instance, listening to a prayer at a school graduation constitutes injury in fact. That was never a basis for legal redress of common law. Listening to something you don't want to hear was not something you could ever sue over. An unwanted display with a religious symbol constitutes injury in fact. The inability to view an endangered species constitutes injury in fact. So we've seen throughout the court's jurisprudence, very minor, almost trivial injuries are enough to confer standing, because the real question for concreteness, I don't think it's what the court said in TransUnion about, is there some tie to the common law? The real inquiry is this plaintiff asserting a mere ideological grievance? Or can they show that they've been affected in a way that goes beyond mere outrage or mere feelings of disagreement with what the government has done? And the problem in TransUnion was the alleged injury was just about some information about the plaintiff appearing in a database. And that felt more like an ideological grievance, right, rather than something that actually affects the person.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Standing is a very important question in this case, but it's not the whole case, because if we found standing but still didn't think that your client deserved any benefits, then that would sort of end the matter. So let's turn to the merits. Let's assume arguendo, and I'm not saying we'll find standing, but let's assume it. Why wasn't the declaration in his favor enough? Why also throwing out the APA was necessary?
Because the language of the APA is mandatory. And it says in Section 706A2, the court shall hold unlawful and set aside agency action that is not in accordance with law. It's a mandate. Shall means must. And the way this court has interpreted the phrase set aside in Section 706 is to equate set aside with vacatur. They said that in data processing, and they said that in Franciscan Alliance. So the current precedent of the Fifth Circuit has equated set aside with vacatur. So it allows plaintiffs to seek the vacatur of agency rules. And there's nothing new about this. The D.C. Circuit has always, for decades, categorically vacated an unlawful agency rule, even when the lawsuit has not been brought as a class action. It allows the solitary plaintiff to seek what is essentially a universal remedy. But that's only the case under the APA, and it's only because that type of remedy is not only statutorily authorized, it's statutorily required. Now, the government, the Department of Justice, has disagreed with this interpretation of set aside. And they presented their arguments in United States against Texas. There was a very interesting concurrence written by Justice Gorsuch that argued against the idea that set aside should be equated with vacatur. And he suggests that you can actually set aside an agency regulation without wiping it off the books. But that opinion only got 3 votes. Professor Harrison's also advocated for this view in a law review article in the Yale Journal of Regulatory Bulletin, I think is what it's called. So there are respectable views against the idea that set aside means vacatur. But the problem for the government is the binding precedent of this court is otherwise. And until this court overrules those decisions in Franciscan Alliance, yes, without a partnership.
That's certainly clear to me, but is it a problem you didn't bring an APA claim? Is that right?
We didn't, but of course we didn't, because the APA claim couldn't have been brought at the time
the reg came up. When was the reg?
October of 2021. Okay. So it was after the deadline for amending the pleadings had passed. So we couldn't have pleaded that because, again, the regulation didn't exist when we sued. It didn't exist when we filed our amended complaint.
Does that make sense for a remand to allow a little more fulsome analysis of it from both sides?
We don't think a remand is necessary, Judge Haynes, because, again, we think vacatur is inevitable once the district court held that the Title X statute cannot preempt state parental consent laws. Given this court's precedent in Franciscan Alliance and data partnership, the cases I mentioned earlier, if this were an open question in the Fifth Circuit, then perhaps a remand would be more sensible. But I just don't see how there's any wiggle room here, given what this court has held. It's still an interesting question about whether set-aside is properly construed to mean vacatur, but this court's precedent, until it's changed, is going to be binding on the district court.
If hypothetically we follow that path, we would not need to reach the parental rights part of this. Is that right?
That's right. It wouldn't be necessary to reach that. And it's often prudent for courts, when there is a statutory basis on which to resolve a case, to avoid the constitutional question, if at all possible. That's the type of concurrence justice Brandeis wrote in Ashwander and ideas of the passive virtues. Sometimes it's better to avoid a constitutional question than to render an unnecessary constitutional pronouncement. We're not necessarily asking the court to do that because we did bring this claim, but it's not necessary for the court to rule on a constitutional question if there's a statutory basis.
There hasn't been much discussion of them, although I quoted from Judge Bork's partial dissent, but there's some 1980s era cases that seem to address similar issues, I guess. What do you say to those? They seem to go against you.
They do, in terms of the holding, but the reasoning is all based on statutory intentionalism and speculation about purposes. It was a different era. The Supreme Court no longer interprets statutes this way. In the early 1980s, there was lots of analysis of legislative history, not only at the Supreme Court, but in the D.C. Circuit, the Second Circuit, some of these other courts that have rejected the argument that we're making here. There's no question other courts have ruled against the argument we're making on the merits, but none of those courts have engaged the statutory text, and none of them have answered the fundamental objection that we've raised from the outset of this litigation, which is the text of 42 U.S.C. Section 300A establishes only a floor, a baseline minimum for parental involvement, when it says that Title X projects shall, to the extent practical, encourage family participation. All that does is set a minimum. It doesn't purport in any way to set a federal ceiling on how much parental involvement can occur. And that remains the case whether the Title X project voluntarily goes beyond that federally mandated floor, or in this case, whether the state of Texas or another state decides, as a matter of state law, to impose additional parental consent requirements, parental involvement requirements that do not appear in the Title X statute. The government's argument only proves that there's no federal requirement of parental consent. We agree with that. We've never in any way suggested that the Title X statute requires the type of regime that we have in Texas to be imposed in all 50 states. All we're saying is that the Title X statute, standing alone, does not preempt state parental consent laws, nor does it authorize Secretary Becerra to issue regulations such as the one that he did that purport to preempt state parental consent laws. And that's all that's needed to resolve this case.
If hypothetically we were to agree with you on that point, do you have a sense of the impact of a decision like that? Meaning a state, that there would be no preemption of a state law right to consent to medical treatment. I thought you said earlier that Texas may be one of the few states, or I don't know if it's the only state that has this.
To my knowledge, Texas is the only state that has a parental consent requirement of this sort. There were other states, I think, that had these, but as you saw in the cases that you were mentioning earlier, Your Honor, from the early 1980s, many of them were challenged in court and declared to be preempted by the Title X statute. Right. So we need to go back and look at the situation. Utah, I think, was one of those states. Are those statutes still on the books? Just because a court declares a preempted doesn't mean that the statute's been erased or struck down. So there may be some other states where some of these laws could potentially spring back into life. But again, this court's decision would only be binding in the Fifth Circuit. So there would be a lot of interesting questions, I think, about agency non-acquiescence and how the federal government might respond to a ruling to really determine what the precise scope would be. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to answer any other questions Your Honors have, either on Article III standing or the merits.
I'm good.
Thank you.
Otherwise, we'll rest on our brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Try and make a few quick points in the time that I have. First, on standing, I don't take plaintiff to be disputing, again, as his brief makes clear, that his argument is that the mere existence of a state law right is sufficient. That is flatly contrary to Article III, and I don't take my...
I guess he's saying there's a state law right, and then obviously this particular plaintiff is in a position to exercise it, and in fact is exercising it. That's what he alleges.
He claims that, to the extent, again, that he can exercise it only in the sense that he is a parent of minor children in Texas. And I take plaintiff to be arguing that every parent of minor children in Texas would have standing to sue HHS, regardless of the likelihood that his or her own individual children would ever seek Title X services.
You haven't addressed the merits at all, so you might want to take some of your time to do that.
Absolutely. Again, on the preemption question, for over 40 years, courts of appeals, every court of appeals to have addressed this question has recognized that the Title X statute, Congress considered the question of family participation in the program, and Congress chose a particular approach. It chose to encourage family participation, and it qualified even that direction with the statutory language to the extent practical. That cannot be reconciled with the approach that plaintiff would have imposed on the Title X program, which is that every Title X provider has to demand parental consent as a condition for seeking services. And I don't think plaintiff to be disputing.
Well, I guess the other way to flip that around is to say Congress may have decided not to impose that as a matter of federal policy, but that doesn't say that Congress also took the much longer step, in my view and in Judge Bork's view, that any state law requirement of notification or consent would be overridden by Title X. That's a different question.
Congress enacted the Title X program to make these important federal services readily available. Congress considered adolescent services to be so important that it explicitly amended the statute to specify those services in the program. And at the same time, Congress debated the question of family participation. It put parental consent and notification requirements in a separate grant program that it enacted at the same time. But with respect to Title X program, again, it chose the statutory language, encourage family participation. And where Congress has made that kind of considered judgment or deliberate choice to use the
Well, word. You say considered judgment, deliberate choice. I see a lot of discussion in those cases about the committee reports and the clarity of the committee reports, but not a whole lot of discussion about the clarity of the statutory language, which is, well, you know, which is frankly sort of goes in Texas's direction. We want to encourage family participation to the extent practicable.
The D.C. Circuit in the Planned Parenthood versus Hecker case, it started with the statutory language. The plain meaning of the word encourage, again, that's to be directed at the person seeking Title X services, to encourage them. And as the D.C. Circuit noted, including the phrase to the extent practical, Congress understood that even that goal of encouraging family participation may well have to give way to other competing considerations. Yes, those courts went on to look at legislative background, committee reports, the fact that Congress rejected other amendments. But in the course of recognizing that everything was speaking with one voice here, all of that confirms what the statutory language provides. And that's the understanding that, again, for over 40 years has been.
Let me ask you this just because we've got to cover every possibility. So let's assume, arguendo again, I'm not saying we'll do this, that we found standing and we found that the declaratory judgment was proper. What is your best case for the proposition that we should nonetheless reverse the APA throwout?
I think it's more about there's several reasons why the district court painted with too broad of a brush with respect to his remedy. I think perhaps most fundamentally, plaintiff did not bring an APA claim. I mean, yes, there are difficult questions.
But your opponent is saying we have the obligation under our precedent to do what the district judge did. And so I'm asking, what is your best case for the proposition that we don't?
But Your Honor, I don't think any of this court's cases applying vacatur under the APA have held that even where someone has not brought an APA claim, that it's just required to vacate a statute. And of course, just under general Article 3 and equitable principles, courts generally do not, you know, go beyond the relief that would be sufficient to remedy any harm to plaintiff. And here, plaintiff stated as late as summary judgment after the regulation was promulgated in October 2021, and plaintiff's filing in July. July 2022. Mm-hmm. After the regulation promulgated, plaintiff stated that he was not seeking to have any rule set aside. Plaintiff was seeking a declaration of his rights.
Hypothetically, if we agreed, though, that there could not be preemption, there is no preemption of the state law, right? Wouldn't it follow as a matter of course that the regulation is, you know, ultra vires, arbitrary and capricious?
I think even with respect to plaintiff himself, plaintiff's own parental rights under Texas law, I mean, the regulation is not specific to contraception services, for example. Mm-hmm. And Texas law does not require parental consent for all possible services. Texas has recognized that minors may seek non-prescription contraception without parental consent. Mm. And There are also other services provided under the Title X program, such as counseling, STI services, things like that.
So do you think a remand then would be the more appropriate remedy? As to the reg?
As to the regulation, if this court believes that some remedy is appropriate, certainly a more finer tuned remedy is mm-hmm. more appropriate than what the district court provided.
Okay. Yes.
But again, the fact that plaintiff did not even bring an APA claim, I think.
Understand.
Is the application of that. Well, we ask that this court reverse. Thank you.